It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week. All this week on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we'll be exploring different aspects of Iowa then and now. This hour, education. Later in the hour, I'll talk with an Iowan who was educated in a one-room schoolhouse and then spent more than three decades as a teacher. And I'll also talk with other Iowans who have stories to share about education over the years. But first, Matthew Hayden is an assistant professor of education at Drake University. He's studied educational history and philosophy. He is with us today. Hello, Matthew.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Now, when the public education system in this country was founded and really being formed and it spread throughout the country, how would you characterize the mission of public schools in the United States?
Originally, public schools in the United States, I mean, if we move away from the early colonial times where there were very local specific reasons, for instance, the Puritans wanted to teach the students how to, or children how to read so they could read the Bible. If we move away from some of those earlier, kind of community-specific ideas, and we start getting more of a national idea, it was primarily situated around producing literate citizens who could contribute economically and politically to their communities and their regions and the nation at large.
So in the curriculum at this time, there was, of course, a strong focus on reading, a strong focus on being able to write and to do math, but also a very strong focus on civics as well so that they could be engaged citizens?
Yeah. And, you know, in it, not as much in a kind of formal sense that we might see now, but much more in a kind of a practical sense where they would have talked about the formation of the government and, you know, governmental systems, but they would have focused a great deal on how to participate in their local communities. This is, you know, when you have town hall meetings, when everyone in the town showed up, they were usually small enough. The issues usually affected everybody. And so it was important that, you know, they really did take the idea of democracy rather literally, and that you needed to be there. It wasn't just that you had this privilege or opportunity to. It was almost as though it was a requirement to be involved.
So cultural literacy was a very important part of the mission of public education. I think it's fairly clear that public education is more than that today, and we'll talk about what public education is about today as we go on. But when did this start to shift? When did it become more than those basics?
We start to see the shift where we're in the kind of the mid to late 1800s, where you start getting more as the idea of a kind of a national system of public schools starts to take form in the minds of folks. You start to get competing ideas for what that might be. And so you have, you know, a public school as a place to you know, give basic literacy training, you know, reading and writing and arithmetic. And then you have, you know, say the Latin grammar schools that started early in the 1800s, that you start to see them more in that classical traditional education in the humanities and liberal arts. You have people saying, well, you know, we should be training kids as they're older so they could, you know, work in the community and be bankers or clerks and so on. And these are all kind of taking shape through the 1800s. And really the big turn where you start to see things coalesce is around the turn of the 1900s, coming into the early 1900s, because that's when progressives, like primarily like Teddy Roosevelt, when he was in New York and he started to make all these reforms in social services, this started to then bleed into education. And so some of those earlier arguments about what education should be, those kind of basic ones mentioned earlier, they decide, well, it seems the schools kind of started to take on all of those because now they're also being asked to take on issues of nutrition, immunization, and health, you know, in the early 1900s. And that continues. We see every decade or two, we start to see these large transformations in what the school is being asked to do.
And that grows through time. It also sounds like there was a stronger class differentiation in early public education, where you were mentioning some of the Latin grammar schools, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, where the idea was that the upper classes needed a different kind of education than the masses?
Yes. In some cases, the Latin grammar schools were publicly funded. In some cases, they kind of turn into that private system. But there's very definitely a class divide that we have at its inception, at least in the national sense, that, you know, really we still have today. The public schools were offered the basic training for, you know, the hoi polloi, if you will, and those who couldn't afford to go to the private schools or the more expensive or even get private tutors. And those schools tended to have – those public schools tended to have, again, more basic training. It was much more – they were also very moralistic. They were very you know, almost factory-like. We're going to bring these kids in. We're going to give them these skills. They're going to go out and they're going to labor for the kids who went to the Latin schools, to the, you know, those humanities and liberal arts schools. And those students were the children of the elite.
Now, there became an idea in the United States and something that we're very proud of in the United States, that education can be the key to a future that doesn't really have anything to do with the class that you were born into. This was the key that is supposed to help you transcend class and be whatever you want to be. When did that idea become part of our schools and part of our culture?
It's hard to say where it took, you know, kind of the form that we know now. But we do know that, you know, from the earliest, even the early 1800s, with particularly the common school movement, there was a sense that, you know, you can stay illiterate and kind of have the life you inherited, or you can become literate and you can create a different life. Social mobility was part of it, but it was also part of the democratic notion of freedom, too, that if you essentially it wasn't necessarily articulated explicitly, but there was this understanding that if you're educated, you will have more choices available to you. And over time, this turns into social mobility, because people who are better educated tend to have greater upward mobility in socioeconomic status. And so they start to become conflated as causal and necessary. And we see that even now today, where people are, you know, even at the higher education level, saying, well, you know, we want our kids to be college ready so they can go to college and then get a degree that gets them a really good high paying job. And so that has kind of almost overtaken some of that in a sense, while, I guess, embedding it within.
Now, there was a huge cultural shift in the United States after World War II. The GI Bill was a really big part of that, where more and more people had access to higher education. It became something that more and more people would strive to do. Did that alter how we educated our students with the idea that they could go on to college?
Definitely. And its impact was primarily felt almost immediately at the post-secondary level in colleges, where they were no longer training the wealthy and the elite. Their middle-class, working-class students on the GI Bill were coming in, and they had different ideas of what college was supposed to be. For them, they saw the idea that when you go to college, you get good jobs and you have a greater social mobility. It was very much tied to a pragmatic goal. And that really started to cause a significant shift in the way people started to look at colleges and universities.
All right. Well, let's take a look at how public schools have changed, let's say, from the 1960s or 70s to today. One thing that you would notice, especially if you look at a junior high schedule or a high school schedule, and you look at the names of the different classes that are offered in these schools, we are not just focusing on algebra and trigonometry and English. There are all kinds of course offerings now in schools. I mean, how has the mission of what a school offers to a child, public education, changed?
I wish everybody could see or go through that list of what those things are. It's a long one. I mean, if we start in the 60s, we're looking at advanced placement gets added, Head Start, Title I, adult education, consumer education, career education gets added. And then in the 70s, we add, you know, drug and alcohol abuse education, parenting education, character education, on and on, women's studies. In the 80s, we get multicultural and ethnic education, global education, keyboarding for computer. It used to be typing, and only a few kids would take it if they were going to become clerks, and now everybody's taking it. We have full-day kindergartens, early childhood education, And on top of all of this, we're adding more and more social services to schools. They're being asked to provide counseling and psychotherapy, all sorts of supports that in some cases, even after school programs are being asked for, and largely because of two parents starting to work. And the latchkey kid that we started hearing about in the 70s, 80s. And I think that's an example of how all of these things that we do to our schools are actually – they come from someplace else. We started doing more after-school programs so we could essentially have our schools be daycare providers for our dual-working parent families. But instead, we don't always see what that cause is, and so then we think if the school's not doing it well, the school – is there's a problem with the school, but we're asking our schools to do so much and not just academically.
Well, and you were talking earlier about the idea of turning out culturally literate students. So, mm-hmm. you know, in the early or the late 19th century, early 20th century, students need to be able to read and do math and vote and participate in their democracy. Now, schools are also still tasked with turning out culturally literate students today. But how would you characterize culturally literate today as opposed to what we were just talking about in the early part of the 20th century?
Yeah, and I think and that's a good question because it highlights one of the major problems with most reform movements now and even the hand-wringing that we're doing over our education system now is that we often compare the current situation to decades past. And it's not an apples and apples comparison. If you look at what it meant to be culturally literate in the 50s, it was primarily, I mean, the dominant culture that you were expected to understand, move within, would be essentially kind of white, primarily WASPy American culture. But after the 60s and civil rights movement and, you know, you get in the 80s and 90s where, you know, globalization becomes a larger force, we now live in a context and in our schools and in our country where now we have a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multilinguistic culture.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Matthew Hayden is an assistant professor of education at Drake University. We're talking about schools then and now, education then and now, as Iowa Week continues on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week, and all week long on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we'll be exploring Iowa then and now. And this hour, we're focusing on education through the years. And one of the biggest changes in Iowa education has to do with the consolidation of school districts. And this is not a new trend. In 1953, Iowa had 4,558 districts. That dropped to 1,065 in 1965. Today, there are 351. So this consolidation of districts has been going on for a long time. And Barb and Dave Else are working to preserve the history of some of Iowa's lost school districts. Together, they published For All the Small Schools, and they both spent their careers in education. Hello.
Hi there, Charity.
Good morning.
Thank you both so much for being here today. Tell me how you got interested in these old schools in Iowa.
It's a long story, but I'll try to shorten it up. Our family was involved with athletics, our children. We have four children, and we always watched the movie Hoosiers and about a small school in Indiana. Well, we visited that school. It was closed, of course, but the trophies were still standing as we looked in the door.
You could actually see them through the windows of the locked schoolhouse?
Yes, yes. And then we got to talking about our school, and Dave had kept an old program from 1958 basketball tournament in Iowa, and a lot of those small schools are no longer open. They're either just sitting there or used for some other thing. So we decided that we would strike out and see if we could find some of these schools and get some history on them. And so that was around, probably 2000.
All right. And you guys were high school sweethearts?
We were. Yes, we were. Wow. We went to Sibley High School up in Northwest Iowa, which the school burned down after we had graduated, and so we have no school to go back to either, really, which is kind of the sadness of this story, of this book, because, you know, we met so many people that would love to go back into their high school to just refresh memories and everything, and the school is no longer there.
Well, and of course, as you drive around the Iowa countryside and as you drive around small towns, I mentioned how school consolidation continues. So when I was growing up, there were a lot of empty country schools, mm-hmm. not just the one-room schoolhouses, but the larger schoolhouses as well. But now in a lot of small towns in Iowa, there are empty schoolhouses, the kinds of schools that we would have all gone to 30 years ago.
Yes, exactly.
It's interesting that even some of the schools that we have in the book, and of course this book focuses on high schools that are no longer in existence, some of those schools have been torn down already, even though they're currently in the book.
Wow. Well, and I think it's surprising that so many of them are still standing. Why have these schools that have been empty for so long, why are they still there?
I think there are probably a number of factors. First of all, there's cost in demolishing schools, especially if they have some of the materials in schools make it difficult and they have to follow regulations.
Like asbestos.
And so that's one reason. I think sometimes the schools have been turned over to the community. Community has not taken the effort to get rid of them. And sometimes they've been purchased by private parties, and they use them for some other business or apartment complexes.
Now, just seeing these old schools, I don't know, I've always been fascinated by them, and for some reason looking at an abandoned empty schoolhouse just invites exploration, although you usually can't get in. It invites so many questions. What is it that really draws you to these structures?
Well, I think the structure itself, in many cases, some of these were beautiful, beautiful buildings. It's interesting that around the 1900s, when high schools were built, they had similar looking outsides. The structures were very similar, typically three stories with the first story kind of in lower level. And even some of the floor plans were very similar. But I think, as Barb mentioned, the thing that has drawn us to the old schools is just thinking about the community in rural education. So much of what goes on in communities, the entire social life revolves around the school. And just thinking back to what that was and how that has changed, and the impact that has had on the state of Iowa.
You are working to preserve, and in this book, you not only publish pictures of the schools, but you also went back and researched so that you could find out what the school mascots were and a little bit of the sports history of the schools. Why do you think that was so important to you and to communities?
So much of what goes on in schools centers on student activities, whether it be athletics, speech and drama, music. It's student activities that draw people into the school, and people develop tremendous allegiances to their school and consequently to the mascots that are associated with the school.
Well, I mean, it's even part of someone's identity. If you're an Ogden Bulldog, you think about yourself as a Bulldog.
And you're always an Ogden Bulldog. That's right.
Was it hard to find this information for these closed schools?
Well, we were really fortunate because we worked with Bud Legg at the Iowa High School Athletic Association, and Bud has made it sort of a lifelong journey to be very accurate and keep track of the mascots and school colors for all of the old schools in Iowa. And you mentioned, Charity, about 1953 being over 4,500 school districts in the state of Iowa. In 1950, there were 775 high schools that had athletic programs. So we had all of these high school communities with mascots and school colors, and people have really hung on to those tightly.
That makes me think about, you were talking about the movie Hoosiers, which of course is about the basketball triumph of a small town basketball team in Indiana. It's one of the greatest movies ever made. And I think it really speaks to that kind of small town identity, that kind of small town pride. One of the things that happened with school consolidation, and it still happens, but it really happened a lot during the 1960s, is that these districts, when they came together, they were bringing together rival districts. How do you think that affected the identity of the students and of the communities?
Well, that's kind of interesting. And when I started out in the superintendency, I was hired at Holstein. And in the first year that I was there, they reorganized with Galva. And they were, in some sense, a rivalry before they came together. The students came together very quickly. Parents had a little bit more difficulty with that. And I think that's understandable, because if you went to a school, you relate to that particular school, and then seeing that school combined with another can be a little bit difficult, and it impacts your identity to a certain extent. And so you can understand how that could happen. But certainly we've had a lot of school districts that have combined with their rivalry.
In looking at these old schools, are there any that you were really impressed with, that someone had taken an old school and really done something beautiful with it?
I was impressed with Lakota. They've done a wonderful job making their school into apartments, and it's just beautiful. They've done an excellent job with that. Let's see, some of the other ones that have done a good job. Oh, New Providence, right close to us here. Their old gym, their roundhouse gym, is been taken care of, and it's just a beautiful building. And they do have a lot of community things happening there. I'm thinking of the antique mall in Marquette. I couldn't think of the name, but that's being used as a, you know, something for the community and the whole area around there.
Now, something else that has happened over the 60 years or 70 years that all of this consolidation of districts has been going on, we've seen a lot of our small towns really struggle economically. Some people believe that the consolidation of districts is partially responsible for that. Some people feel that it's just something that has happened in parallel as our small towns have gotten smaller and our economy has changed. What's your take on it? When a town loses its school, what do you think that does to the town?
I think it's very difficult to keep a town active and vibrant if and when the school is gone, because people come to activities of their children and they step downtown and they pick up groceries or whatever and go to the barber shop. And when the school is no longer being used, it's hard to keep the downtown going.
You know, one of the beauties of all of this was the opportunity to talk to people and communities. You know, one man said, once the school goes, then the churches start to go. When the churches go, the community goes. And we found that to be somewhat true in many of these communities, that once the school closed, it just really impacted the vibrancy of the community.
Now, I mentioned that both of you have had long careers in education. Dave, you have done many things over the years. Among your jobs over the years, you were the director of Price Laboratory School in Cedar Falls and the head of the Department of Teaching at the University of Northern Iowa from 1988 to 1990. And, of course, that school, Price Lab, Northern University High School, has closed in recent years, not because of district consolidation, but other reasons. How do you feel about that? Do you feel like that changes your history and the community of Cedar Falls to lose something like that?
Well, you know, two of our sons went to Northern University High, and so you have that special attachment. And what we discovered in this whole project was the emotions that go along with schools being active and lively and people feeling good about them to the school simply closing and no longer being there. And all of the memories that you have attached with that school, they're lost. You know, the closing of Price Laboratory School had a tremendous impact on a number of people.
Right now, so many communities are struggling with their infrastructure in their school districts and building new buildings and trying to decide whether, you know, they want to have smaller neighborhood schools or larger elementary schools. A lot of old facilities are being closed. A lot of new structures are being built on the outskirts of communities. Do you think that changes the dynamic today?
You know, it's interesting that you say they're being built on the outskirts. When Barb and I would go into a community, and we didn't know where the school was at, we always looked to the edge of town, and typically we looked to the west side or to the north side, and for whatever reason, that's oftentimes where we found it.
Interesting.
And the reason they built them on the outskirts was because they anticipated that homes would be built around the school. Well, in many communities, that didn't happen. But you're right. That's a great observation. Now it's happening again, and we're building. And part of that is availability of property, but they are building on the outskirts.
In uncovering these old memories, these old stories, have you heard from a lot of people who looked at your book and found their high school mascot and shared some of their memories?
We have, Charity. We have. It's been very interesting. In fact, we've had some cases where we had some corrections to be made, and we were told that that isn't right, that I graduated in that year, and I know that such and such, or that wasn't our mascot. But for the most part, people have been really, really supportive and very gracious to us.
You know, there are so many stories to be told, and people hang on to those. The Creslin early Litton basketball game in 1982 was the longest overtime boys basketball game in Iowa history. Calumet went to the state boys basketball tournament 5 years in a row, and they will tell you about beating the larger schools during the single class tournament. Melrose, the very smallest school in Iowa to ever win a single class basketball tournament. There were just lots of those. Renwick, 1929, where they had to take the train because of a snowstorm to Britt. And they first took a train to Laverne and then got on another train to go to Britt to play in a sectional tournament, if you can imagine that. We would never do that today. Or Numa and Seymour girls in the state basketball tournament in 1941, they played in the championship game, and they are 6 miles apart geographically. So just some interesting stories, and people hang on to those stories. They want to tell you about them.
Do you think that there's anything that superintendents or school boards of today's districts can take away from the stories that you collected?
I think it's important that we all understand how the social fabric of a community is woven within the school. And so much of rural Iowa, everything centered on the school and the support that they have for children, and the belief that because they were a small school, they could determine what was best for their children's education. And they could, in fact, influence that education because they were a small school. I think we have to look carefully at the value that we place on rural education in Iowa. All of these school districts are facing difficult times because of declining enrollment. And under the current funding structure for Iowa education, it's very, very difficult for small schools to survive. And so if we truly value small rural schools in Iowa, we need to look at options for funding to keep those schools alive and in turn keep those communities vibrant.
That was going to be my next question. It sounds like you feel like there's a lot more at stake there than just the school.
There's a lot more at stake, definitely. I think these small rural communities add so much to the state of Iowa. And to lose those, we lose some of the values that go along with those schools and communities.
Dave and Barb Ells, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Charity.
Thank you, Charity.
Barb and Dave Ells both spent many years working in education themselves. They are now working to preserve the history of some of Iowa's lost school districts. Together, they published For All the Small Schools. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week, and all week long we're talking about Iowa, then and now. And this hour, our focus is education. And with me is David Jackson. He is something of an accidental school historian. Hello, David.
Hi, nice to meet you, Charity, and glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much. Now, you live in an old school. Tell me about the school that you live in.
Well, I actually don't live in the school. I live on the property where the school foundation is. This is the site of an old town, Hinkletown, Iowa, that was settled in the late 1840s or early 1850s. As it would be, the settlers wanted very early to have good education for their kids. And so the Hinkletown or Hickory Ridge School was actually built in 1849. And I do have an old settler's account of how the school was built. So that's how it started.
All right. And the school closed in 1949.
You bet. So 100 years.
Right.
100 years of education.
A lot of people, because there were so many country schools, a lot of people live on property that used to be occupied by a school or live in a house that was made out of a modified schoolhouse. And not everyone turns into a school historian. So how did that happen?
Well, it was a fluke, as you said, and it happened when people started coming by and visiting the old site. It was around Memorial Day when people would come out to the graves and want to honor their families and lay flowers, and they would drive by the old school site, and sure enough, they'd mosey on up to the house and have a conversation. And those conversations turned into friendships very quickly. Those friendships grew into extended networking, and then back in 2002, a little one-page website, which grew into many, many pages, grew into memories and sharing. And then next thing you know, around 2002 and 8, we started doing actual reunions out on the site and would bring some of the alumni and their families, and so it grew from there.
Now, you're not a native Iowan, and you don't have any prior connection with this school. What was it, do you think? I mean, beyond those friendships that you struck up, was there a story that you heard in those early days? What hooked you?
Well, it really started when I bought this farmland out in the middle of Iowa County, or actually at the southeast corner of Iowa County. And everywhere we dug initially, when Margaret and I were putting in some fence and would dig fence posts, and everywhere we dug, we'd come up with bricks. Didn't matter where on the property it was, but we would come up with old broken bricks. And those bricks started calling out to me. I wondered just what is going on here and discovered there was an old ghost town there, 4 general stores, a doctor's office, a post office, a school, things like that.
So this wasn't a standalone country school. This was part of a town.
Yes, it was part of a very thriving and robust town at one time, and extended rural residents, farms, houses, and the kids would walk for a couple miles to come to this school, both in Keokuk County and Iowa County. So it actually served portions of 2 counties.
Can you share with me, I know you've collected so many memories from people who attended these schools or had connections with the school over the years. Can you share a memory with me?
Well, the very first one is actually from a a story that came out of the Oskaloosa Globe, of all places, and back in 1905. And it was included in the diary of one of the early settlers at Hinkletown. And so he talks about the building of the school. That summer of 1849, the settlers got together and built a log schoolhouse. It was built in Iowa County. The schoolhouse stood up on a big hill and was surrounded by hickory timber, so the school was called Hickory Grove. The schoolhouse was 16 by 18 feet and was covered with shingles made out of oak timber, shaved out with a drawing knife. The floor was made of rough oak boards. We sent down to Washington County for a teacher. We got Miss Gowie, who taught school at that summer and fall. We had no school in the winter, as the pupils lived too far to come in the winter, and the teachers were hard to get. The school had an average of about 15 pupils. The school teacher boarded with her brothers, who lived a quarter mile west of us. And this was written by Mordecai Souter, who was one of the first settlers in the 1840s out at Hinkletown.
So I know that you have a very strong interest in history. You've become the president of English Valley's History Center, and so you're interest in the area that you live in goes beyond just the school. But
sure.
I understand wanting to understand your community or your part of the state. For people who don't have that personal connection with this area, what do you think we can take away from the history and the stories that you've collected about Hickory Ridge School?
Well, it's always to get people further interested in their area, their roots, their family, generations back. Also, you know, I think there's a certain amount of history that repeats itself, but also celebrating what used to be is important. You know, the ultimate goal of the country school was to get students ready with an eighth grade examination to pass that. And I found in reading that, through that examination, I couldn't answer, and most of us could not answer those questions today. It
really
was very much a different time, different place. Do you want to hear a couple?
Sure. Give me a couple.
There were, you know, questions in a lot of area, including civics and grammar and writing, orthology, as they called it, the spelling. And, you know, it's amazing what children were asked to answer. So, draw a map of their own county and every township and identify it by memory. They're in the area of literary. Who wrote The Village Blacksmith, The Great Stone Face, Snowbound, The Man Without a Country, The Gettysburg Address? Name three books you've read in the past year. Which did you like the best? And give all the reasons. How about this one in civics? Describe the Constitution of Iowa, the Code of Iowa. Name two duties of each by the following officers: county superintendent, county auditor, county sheriff, county recorder, and county attorney. Name the divisions of state government. What are the duties of the railroad commissioner?
Wow. So,
yeah, a lot of neat questions they had to answer.
Well, David Jackson, thank you so much for being here today.
You bet. Thank you, Charity.
David Jackson has compiled the history of Hickory Ridge School in Iowa County. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. My next guest attended a one-room country school in Highlandville, Iowa, north of Decorah, and later spent more than 35 years teaching elementary school. She spent the majority of her career at Southdale Elementary School in Cedar Falls, where she was my teacher for both first and second grade. Barb Dowd is with me now. Hello, Barb.
Hello, Charity. Good to hear from you again.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to go back to that country school experience you had when you were a kid. That was one of the later country schools. Tell me what it was like.
Yes, it was a one-room schoolhouse. I did ride the bus to it. We lived like a quarter of a mile away. One-room schoolhouse, outhouse toilets, K through 3. And I went to country school up until fifth grade, and then they started busing kids to town.
Wow. So you were in the same classroom with all the different grades. How many students were in school with you?
Oh, probably 20 to 25, maybe.
And how did it go on a daily basis? I mean, you had just the one teacher, right?
just one teacher, and when she'd call up a group, like whatever grade or level, then you'd work maybe with other kids, you know, that were younger than you, working with the letters of the alphabet or addition, subtraction, facts, and, you know, different things to help them out.
So when you switched from that one-room school into probably something that's more like a kind of school that we would see today, was it a big transition for you?
Yeah, it was different. I knew some of the kids anyway between music lessons and dance lessons that my mom had taken me into town. And they were actually having to build schools because all of us country kids are coming into town. So we had to go to a church and have fifth grade in a church until the school was built and ready to go the next year. So the first year we were in like different churches around town.
When you were at country school, you were helping other students who were younger than you sometimes, but mm-hmm. I'm guessing you also had to spend quite a bit of time working independently. Was that a transition for you, being in a fifth grade class where you were all doing the same thing and the teacher was probably paying more attention to what you were doing?
Well, that's true, too. I don't think it was a big transition by then. You know, I was older, so it was fine, and we were setting band then. So it was different fun things, you know, to do in-town school, too, as we called it. But I rode the bus an hour in the morning and an hour at night.
Wow, that must have been a transition.
Yeah, it was almost dark when you're getting off the bus, you know, in the wintertime.
Now, you focused on elementary school. You started out teaching first grade in Spring Grove, right?
Yes.
All right. And then you moved to Cedar Falls, and you moved around a little bit over the years, first, second, and third grades.
Yes. Teaching second most of the years.
In teaching in a more modern and traditional public school, was there anything from your early country school experience that you brought to that?
Oh, probably. Well, I have my love of music. As you recall, I had a piano in my room, which was kind of, I think I was probably the only teacher in Cedar Falls that had a piano in her room. So I brought the music into the classroom that way.
And that was something that you'd experienced at country school?
Yeah, there was a piano in the country school, too.
Well, we did all love that very, very, very much.
Yeah, it was kind of nice when they're getting their coats on at the end of the day instead of just chit-chatting, you know. We had our songs we sang, and I think everybody enjoyed it.
Now, when you spent more than 35 years teaching these early grades, you probably saw a lot of different changes over the years. And I constantly am reading about new studies about how kids learn and different ways to teach reading and different ways to teach math. What are some of the biggest changes that you really experienced as a teacher over those 35 years?
Oh, lots of changes, especially in the last 10, probably, that I taught. More accountability, more record keeping, you know, didn't feel like you were spending as much time actually with the kids. It was more testing, teaching for the test than just actually working with the individual students.
With some of the changes over the years, as far as teaching kids how to read, I know that there's been a little bit of back and forth, a focus on phonics and then moving away from that and moving back toward phonics. As some of those different curriculum changes came down, given your experience, did that affect how you felt about it?
Right, yeah, and it's probably going to come around again. It seems like every probably 15 years they start one thing and then they switch it, you know, and every kid learns a different way, whether it's now or it was back in 1980 or 90. Everybody still, you know, has their own way that they can learn the best. So I kind of have to still gear it, I think, toward the individual student.
Did you ever feel like your hands were tied by the new curriculum and an inability to teach a child the way you felt that child needed to learn?
Right, yeah, because there's, you know, different ways. And if you even know it works with one kid, they're like, no, you can't do that now. You have to do it the new way. Well, that's not always going to be the best for every kid, I don't feel. And it's developmental, too. Somebody's going to read a kindergarten and somebody's not going to read till second grade. But they'll probably all end up going, you know, most majority going on to post-education after high school.
With the changes toward more accountability, more testing, did you feel like that gave you a better handle on knowing how the kids were doing?
Sometimes, but usually at the, you know, the grade levels I was teaching, you know, if someone can read or knows their math facts, you don't have to give them a 10-page test, you know.
Did you feel like it got in your way?
Yes, it did. It was just like one day a week, they'd take a sub in for us just to test all the kids on reading. Well, you already knew pre-testing who was going to, you know, go with flying colors and who probably needed extra help.
Now, one of the big changes in classrooms, of course, has been technology, and that continues to change and change and change. In your classroom, when you retired, did you have a lot of technology?
Yeah, we've had a computer lab at Southfield probably all 15, 20 years before I retired.
Is there something about that kind of technology in the classroom that you loved?
Yeah, it was a good way to show different things to kids lots of times instead of just, you know, so it's varied the learning experience a little bit, I think, for them. And the kids nowadays, they're so used to computers, and my 3-year-old granddaughters know the code for the iPad and can use the iPad. So the kids are growing up with it now, so that, you know, it's definitely going to be a different way of teaching in the next few years, I think.
So in the years that you taught, there were changes not just in your classroom, but also in how kids interacted with school. I know that what kids used to walk to school almost all the time. What are some of the other changes that you saw over the years?
Right, especially Southfield, when you're going there, a lot of the kids went home for lunch every day. And when I first taught at Southfield, they didn't have hot lunch. Kids either had to bring their lunch or walk home. Well, at that time, a lot of moms in the 70s weren't working, so the kids could walk home for lunch every day, unsupervised, whereas now most of the parents would pick them up, you know, meet them at the door at school. But it was safe enough back then. The kids would walk home for lunch, a lot of them.
Do you think that recess time has been cut back over the years that you were in education?
Yes, and I think, firm believer, the kids need to get out, run around a little bit and get some fresh air, and then they come back in and they're a little bit more rejuvenated and ready to go back to work. Even what they went down to 2 recesses the last, right after I quit teaching. So first graders were in the room from like 8:30 in the morning till noon.
Wow.
Without a break. Yeah.
When you think about teachers today, you have so much experience, and I know that you know a number of young teachers who are early in their careers. What's one piece of advice that you would give them from all of the years that you spent in the classroom?
Probably just enjoy the kids every day, because the kids still are kids. I still love kids. Kids, you know, still want to learn, and they love their teacher. They'll have to deal with the different changes in all the curriculum and everything, but the kids and parents are still, you know, great, and I always enjoyed them.
Well, Barb, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great to hear from you again, Charity.
Barb Dowd of Cedar Falls, Iowa. She taught at Southdale Elementary School for more than 30 years. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.